Is it a question that everybody would like? Possibly. Okay, hold on. Let me get everything set here. Okay, this is looking good. Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. There we go. That's a little bit better. Bio 241, and it is Tuesday, February 1st. We're going to finish up chemical composition of the body today, your last lecture on that, and then probably move on to chapter 6. And we'll cover 6 next time, and then also maybe a little bit on Tuesday of next week. And that's it for the first test, right? Because then you have your first test next Thursday, so about a week and a half. So, three is on there as well. Cell structure and genetic control. Yeah, it's 1, 2, 3, and 6. And we're only on the second chapter. So we got to cover a couple more chapters. Indeed. Let's get started then right away. The lectures are online. It took me a little while to get that web page worked out, but it's there. There's just one lecture that ran really long because I forgot to turn off the recorder, and I was talking to people, and I used their names, and I have to edit that part out of the lecture. I think it was the first lecture on chemistry. Okay, and I'll put that on, but that seems to be working. Here's a sign-in sheet. Please pass that around. And you people in the back, please bring it down when you're done. After lecture, please. Okay, so does anybody have any questions on chemistry so far? You know what you have to study? Oh, here's a question. Yeah.
I have a question actually about the syllabus.
Oh, the syllabus, yeah.
The last chapter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're going to cover that in lab. Okay, and you do have a module in Blackboard on digestive system, and your lab instructor is going to give you an orientation or some kind of lecture for the digestive system. You noticed that. Really good. Okay, but that's you have a whole module, a weekly module in Blackboard for that one too. All right, so we talked about pH last time. As something becomes more acidic, what goes in the same direction? What's directly related to acidity of a solution? Hydrogen ion concentration. You should know that, okay? But there is a way that we talk about hydrogen ion concentration, which is inversely related to hydrogen ion concentration. And what is that? That is pH. That's right. So as the solution becomes more acidic, hydrogen ion concentration increases, but the pH number gets smaller, right? It decreases. So don't be tricked on that one. It's not meant to be tricky. It's just the way it goes. All right, then we talked about the four main classes of important biological compounds in your body. What are those four major classes? Carbohydrates. What's the building block of a complex carbohydrate? Monosaccharide, simple sugar. Okay, so carbohydrates is one. We talked also about lipids. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? Fatty acids, how many?
Three,
because that's in the name, and one glycerol, okay? And then, let's see, what else did we talk about? That was it. That takes us to proteins. So, you should know what the building block of a protein is as well. And you knew that before taking this class, that's an amino acid. So, you could think of a protein as being a word, and what do you use to spell out a word? Letters, that's right. So, if a protein is a word, what do we use to spell out a protein? Amino acids. Amino acids are the letters that your body uses to actually spell out a protein. All right? Another way of saying that is that amino acids are the building blocks for proteins. And there are about 20 important amino acids in your body. Some of these your body can make. Others of these amino acids your body cannot make, but you need them in order to make proteins, and those are what we call essential amino acids. So if your body can't make them, where do they come from? Come from your diet. You have to have them in your diet, or you'll be deficient in certain kinds of proteins in your body. So here is just a typical example of an amino acid. Oh, I remember now we were talking about this last time. This carboxyl group here is the acid part of the molecule, right? So here is the amino group right here. And then from the central carbon, this R just represents that there's this group right here will have different substitutions depending on the particular amino acid. And we said there are going to be 20 different amino acids, so there'll be 20 different groups that can bind to this central carbon to make it a different amino acid. So here are some that are going to be nonpolar side chains, right? So these are hydrophobic groups. These are just hydrocarbons, right? These side chains don't like to dissolve in water. And then these down over here will be some polar side chains that do like to dissolve in water, okay? And so the way that we make a protein is by combining these amino acids together. And what kind of chemical reaction would you guess that we could use to make a polymer of amino acids to make a protein? What kind of chemical reaction did we use to make a triglyceride or a polysaccharide? Dehydration synthesis reaction, exactly right. So here we have an OH and here we have a hydrogen. These can come off to form a water molecule, and then we have a nice covalent bond right here. So proteins or peptides are short chains of amino acids. Those are peptides. And that, when we do a dehydration synthesis reaction, that forms a peptide bond. It's a nice covalent bond right here. That's a very strong, stable covalent bond. So proteins in this sense are pretty stable. It's difficult to break a protein down into its basic amino acids or its component amino acids, right? I don't mean in terms of a pH sense. And that's via a dehydration synthesis reaction. But if you want to break a protein down, what kind of reaction do you have to undergo? A hydrolysis reaction. So you need water to break this peptide bond, but it's relatively hard to do that. And somebody mentioned digestive system. The place where this starts is the stomach. And does anybody kind of have an idea what the pH of the stomach is? Oh, it's very acidic. It's a very strange pH. It's a very strange environment. But that kind of environment is necessary to start this initial digestion of peptide bonds, right? It's a pH of about 1 or 2. Okay, so if we have a polymer of amino acids, if it's less than 100 amino acids, we have a tendency to call that a polypeptide. If it's greater than 100 amino acids, then that's a protein. So these are what? Typically very long words. But these peptides don't necessarily have to be very long. There are some hormones that only have 8 amino acids in them. So they could be a short sequence as well. Okay. So we want to talk about protein structure, because that structure is going to determine what its function is going to be. And proteins can have a wide range of functions because of its almost unlimited amount of different kinds of structures that proteins can form. And the first kind of structure that we want to consider is what we call primary structure. And that is just the amino acid sequence that's going to make a polymer, right? And a polymer is what? It's just a big, long molecule made out of repeating units. And that repeating unit in a protein is called an what? Amino acid, right? And some of these amino acids will be different because this R group will have different substitutions in it. Nonetheless, all right, the primary structure is just the sequence of the amino acids that make up the protein. And these amino acids could be all the same amino acid. For instance, maybe it could be valine, 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 valine. Or it could have different amino acids. It could be valine, tyrosine, arginine, cysteine, and aspartic acid all in that particular order, and that would spell out, right, that particular protein. All right, now on the test, you don't have to know the names of these different amino acids right here, but you do have to be able to recognize this as being an amino acid, right? Just like this one here is an amino acid as well. Okay, because it has an amino group, carboxyl group, that's the acid part. All right, so primary structure is just how you would spell a word out. But because of substitution in these R groups right here, that's going to change how that protein starts to bend and fold when it's put in solution. And if the primary sequence is just right, it can form something that looks like this spring right here, and we call that an alpha helix. And the alpha helix is stabilized by hydrogen bonds between different amino acids within the protein sequence. Now, what kind of bond is a hydrogen bond in terms of strength? It's a relatively weak bond. This is kind of stable because look at all the hydrogen bonds, right, that form this alpha helix. There are many, many of them, but each one individually is pretty weak. So this alpha helix is fairly stable, but in radical conditions, maybe of very acidic conditions or very basic conditions or salty conditions or in temperature, these hydrogen bonds can break and this alpha helix then will become distorted. It will change its shape. And when it changes its shape, what should you expect? The function of that protein is going to change, right? There's another kind of structure besides the alpha helix. It's called a beta pleated sheet, and it almost looks like an alpha helix, but it has a little bit sharper turns in it. It looks more like an accordion. And again, there are hydrogen bonds between different amino acids along that protein sequence. So this structure right here is built upon a building block. What's the building block of an alpha helix or a beta pleated sheet, which we call secondary structure? What's the building block of secondary structure? What has to be there before an alpha helix or a beta pleated sheet can form? The correct primary structure. That's right. So primary structure is the building block for secondary structure, whether it's an alpha helix or a beta pleated sheet. All right, so this is just a portion of that protein molecule. But let's consider the whole protein molecule. So here is a big polymer of amino acids, and you can see that this sequence of amino acids right here is proper to form an alpha helix. And then one over here is proper to form this, like a hairpin turn right here, and then we got a couple straight segments, and it just kind of curls around like this. This is the third level of structure of proteins, and we call it a tertiary structure. And we're looking at it just on a two-dimensional picture, but you should think of this as a three-dimensional object, right? So it has a particular three-dimensional shape that you could look at from the top or the bottom or any of the sides. All right, so what's the building block for tertiary structure? It's secondary structure, right? Without this alpha helix right here, then this protein won't form this conformation or this structure. All right, and that alpha helix is built upon what? The primary structure. So all of these structures lead to something bigger. So think if you had to learn the hierarchical organization of structure and function in anatomy. Think of that same that organization in terms of protein structure, and then that's going to help determine the function. And in this particular case, we have this kind of globular protein, and it's got a special little region on the interior of this molecule that can actually bind a special group we call a heme group. And this heme group function is to actually carry oxygen. It can bind oxygen. So when we get to the respiratory chapter, we're going to be really interested in this molecule. For instance, this would be a hemoglobin molecule. Okay, but hemoglobin just doesn't have one protein chain. All right, it actually is combined of four protein chains, and each one of these protein chains has a heme group in it. So for every hemoglobin molecule, it can bind and carry four oxygen molecules. All right, and the reason why this heme group fits inside the molecule is because it has the proper tertiary structure, and that's determined by the secondary structure, which is determined by the primary structure of that protein. So all of those are building blocks to what we then can see as the quaternary structure of a protein. And the quaternary structure is just when numerous, more or at least more than one protein molecule combine together to form like this super molecule right here that has four different kinds of proteins that make it up. There's actually two. Two of the subunits are similar. Two of the other subunits are pretty similar as well. Okay. And most of these proteins right here are held together by hydrogen bonds, which are pretty weak bonds. There are some other bonds that can also help stabilize a protein molecule. But if it's just hydrogen bonds, it can be disrupted by, like I said, pH, high temperatures, even salty conditions. All right, will change the nature of a protein. That process of changing the shape of a protein by drastically changing the temperature or pH or salt is what we call denaturation. Denaturation causes a conformation change of the protein, and of course then that function of the protein is going to stop as well. And denaturation is an irreversible process. Once a protein is denatured, right, even if you go back to the proper temperature or pH, the protein won't find its what we call native configuration. It's normal configuration that has certain activity. And you're all aware of this because how do you denature proteins all the time? I'll give you a hint. 3 times a day. We probably don't do that, but maybe you start out by doing that. What are the 3 times a day that you would denature a protein? For instance, when you cook food, for instance, like if you cook an egg, you see it goes from the white of an egg changes from kind of a translucent or clear material to something that's very white and opaque and kind of hard. It just means that the proteins have changed shape when you cook an egg. All right. A good way to think of denaturation as being an irreversible process. Let's just say that I'm going to go home and cook a hamburger tonight on the barbecue. And does a raw hamburger look the same as a cooked hamburger? Absolutely. Totally different, right? Because the proteins have changed shape. It's been denatured by heat. Okay, so I cooked some hamburgers. I'm ready to sit down and eat. But then I get a phone call from a friend. And they say, oh, you know what? We've got 3 people and a pool table just opened up. And we need a 4th person. You're that person. We need you really bad. And so what am I going to say? Oh, I'm sorry. I can't go down and shoot pool with you right now because I've just cooked a hamburger and I got to eat the hamburger. Absolutely not. Okay? I'm going to do something with the hamburger and go shoot pool for a little while with my friends. I don't want to let them down. So I'll take the cooked hamburger and put it back in the refrigerator. Does that cooked hamburger go back to looking like a raw hamburger then after that? No, it changes temperature, but you can't get back to the native configuration of all those proteins. And the reason why we cook it is because then that stabilizes those proteins, it kills the bacteria, and it just preserves the nutrition in that material so it can't degrade. So that's an important concept. There's only one time that I can think of where we denature proteins and we can get it back to more or less its native configuration. Hair is made out of proteins. And there are certain kinds of bonds within hair that can form curls. And those are the disulfide bridges, the disulfide bonds from a cysteine amino acid that I talked about last time. And those bonds can be broken. You can put your hair in a certain kind of configuration and reform those disulfide bridges between different filaments of protein in hair. And then your hair will take a different shape, a different curl to it. Okay, so those proteins have been denatured. And if you don't like that curl, guess what you can do? You can actually straighten the hair out by breaking those bonds again. So you can like renature those proteins and then denature them in different circumstances. So that's the only time that I'm aware of that we can actually change the structure of proteins and kind of get it back to the way it was. All right, so that's something about denaturation. So salt, pH, salt concentration, pH, temperature are ways that we can denature proteins, and all of those are used to actually cook food. You can cook food at low temperature by doing what with it? And maybe give me an example. How can you cook food? By changing just the pH. How about like using some lemon juice to cook fish to make ceviche, right? Or you can, anybody have that? Or you can use high salt concentrations to cook. Yeah, like brine to cook, or pH. Right, you can cook meat with. You can denature the protein and preserve it. What would be? Oh, that was like ceviche was a good example of that, using the acid in lemon juice to do that. Okay, so here we see a conformation or a certain protein that has a certain bend to it. So we see the tertiary structure of a protein. So what can stabilize this certain bending configuration of this protein right here? We said that there can be hydrogen bonds between different amino acids. So there could be maybe 50 or 100 amino acids different between this position in a protein and this position right here. And if we have these amino acids, then they can form a nice hydrogen bond to maintain this loop, this little bend. All right, so this is a hydrogen bond. Here we might have an amino group and a carboxyl group, and they deionize and forms an ionic bond. So this is what? A little bit stronger stabilizing influence on a protein. All right, but if we change the pH, what happens to this ionic bond? It's going to change, right? And so this bond then is broken, or by changing the salt concentration or the pH, it's going to influence the nature of this bond right here. And here is maybe a cysteine amino acid, and then maybe 100 amino acids later, there's another cysteine right here, which is a salt hydryl group, and that can form a disulfide bridge. Now, this is a covalent bond. What's the strength of a covalent bond?
Positive. strong.
It's very strong. So this is a very stabilizing influence. Right? So your hair, if you have curly hair, it really doesn't denature when you take a hot shower, okay, because it can't break this covalent bond. But if you go to a beautician, they know how to break this bond and then reform it. I don't know the chemicals involved with that, but there's probably some people in here that know how to do that. All right, so that's a very strong bond. And here is the weakest bond of all that we haven't talked about yet. So covalent is the strongest, ionic is a little bit weaker, hydrogen is weaker still, and the third kind of bond is so weak that maybe we shouldn't even talk about it as like a bond, but it is, think of it as a bond that will cause different parts of a protein molecule to join together, and it's called van der Waals forces. Van der Waals forces are due to interactions between hydrophobic groups. So if on an amino acid there's a hydrophobic group, it wants to be around another hydrophobic molecule someplace, right? It doesn't want to be around an ion or some kind of polar molecule. And so these different groups, right, like valine groups right here, or tyrosine groups, will want to be close to each other, and that will be kind of a minimal stabilizing influence on a protein, but can be easily broken. All right, so make sure you know those four kinds of bonds. Okay, proteins. Besides the almost infinite number of different kinds of configurations it can take, right, it can still be modified further by adding other groups to them, other important kinds of biological compounds, like sugar molecules or lipid molecules. So when we take a protein and join another group to it, we call that conjugation. So if we have a protein and add a sugar molecule to it, we form a glycoprotein. Glyco just means sugar, and of course protein means protein. And lipoproteins contain protein and lipids as well, right? And so now we're drastically changing the structure of that protein and then the function of it as well. And others, like we talked about, hemoglobin, for instance, will contain a pigment, right? That's that heme group, and a pigment is just something that can absorb light. And you probably know, what does blood look like when it's oxygenated?
Red,
because it has that pigment in it called the heme group. And that heme group, since it's a pigment, will absorb all different wavelengths of light except for the red wavelength. So when white light is shown on it, it absorbs blue, it absorbs yellow and green, and it reflects red, so your eye picks up that red color. So pigments are chemical compounds in substances that can produce color. Like in your chairs, what pigment is in there? Gosh, I don't really know. Is that green or yellow, your chairs? It's yellow, right? So there's a yellow pigment in there. So all other wavelengths are absorbed, and that yellow wavelength is reflected back to your eye to see. So it appears as a particular color. And if there is something that is white, like where I have the cursor right here, it is not absorbing any kind of light energy. It's reflecting all wavelengths, all colors back to your eye, and then you perceive that as a white color. All right, so there can be other pigments associated with proteins to give them special kinds of functions. Okay, that takes us to another class of compounds called nucleic acids. And nucleic acids would be things like RNA and DNA. And you got to know the basic building block of RNA and DNA, and those things are called nucleotides. So nucleotides are like the amino acid. And nucleic acids are polymers, just like polysaccharides are, just like proteins are, just like triglycerides are, and it includes both DNA and RNA. And so you got to know what DNA stands for and what RNA stands for. DNA is what? Deoxyribonucleic acid. And RNA stands for ribonucleic acid. This deoxy and ribo comes from a sugar molecule that's used to make a nucleotide. So here we have a diagram of a nucleotide, and you've got to be able to recognize this as being a nucleotide. How do you know this is not an amino acid? I don't see a carboxyl group. I don't see an amino group on that central carbon. I see a 5-carbon sugar right here. And then I see there's a phosphate group, and you should know what a phosphate group looks like, right? It's a PO4 group right here. And then off the other end of the 5-carbon sugar, there is a base molecule. It's a basic kind of molecule. And so there are a number of, there's only 5 different kinds of bases that can bind to a nucleotide in our bodies. Okay, but in every case, it's going to be a 5-carbon sugar. So the phosphate group, the 5-carbon sugar, and a base are the building blocks of a nucleotide. And there are 4 different bases that can be used in DNA. And those bases are guanine, thymine, cytosine, and adenine. And you don't have to know what that shape looks like, but you should at least know that these are names of bases that you find in DNA, and not necessarily in RNA. So here is the basic building block of a nucleic acid. It can be put together to form a polymer. And what kind of reaction would you use to form a polymer? Take a bunch of nucleotides and make a nucleic acid out of it. What would you use? A dehydration synthesis reaction, exactly right. Okay, so there are hydroxyl groups and some proton groups on the other molecule. And it can form a strand of nucleic acid right here. So here I see just a single strand. And when you look at this, you should see that the backbone of a nucleic acid is alternating groups. What are the groups that alternate to form a strand of a nucleic acid? You have, what's this right here? Phosphate and sugar. Phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar. Right? That's the backbone of a strand. And then sticking off the side of the strand are the bases right here. And the guanine and adenine are relatively large molecules. The thymine and cytosine right here are relatively small. And if you kind of look at that on edge right there, that reminds me of something. What does that remind me of? The shape kind of is like a little jagged edge right here. Depending on how you spell out this nucleic acid, it's going to have a different three-dimensional shape, right? And what does that remind me of? Look what I have right here. I have a key. I've got some high points on the key, and I got some low points. And what can you tell me about these high points and low points if I want to open up a certain lock? It's got to match up to the lock, right? And if the high points and low points don't have the right structure, it's not going to open up the lock. So the way you spell out a nucleic acid is very important in terms of the information. So there's information even in each one of these keys that I have, right? And it's encoded in what? Just the height of these little teeth, okay? All right, so that's one important thing that I want you to know. So what are the 3 building blocks that make a nucleic acid up? You got A, phosphate,
sugar.
Well, how many carbons in that sugar?
5,
and then a base. Yeah, and a base. Okay. All right, so let's see what can happen. For DNA, oh yeah, we talked about this already. For DNA, DNA is always going to be double-stranded. You're going to have 2 strands. The strands are going to come together, and the bases are going to interact. All right, so if on one side of a DNA molecule you got a guanine, which is a big molecule, what do you think that has the base pair on the other side in order for these strands to fit together? It's got to be a small one, all right? And the one that fits properly, it could be thymine or cytosine, because these are small molecules that will fit next to it. It will fit in the right spot. But because of hydrogen bonding that we're going to look at in the next slide, guanine will always base pair with cytosine, right? And that means then that adenine right here is going to have to base pair with a small base, and it's going to be thymine because of the proper alignment of hydrogen bonds. So let's take a look at how that happens. So here we see that guanine and cytosine always base pair. So think of this as being a strand of DNA, and then there's a strand of DNA over here. Cytosine and guanine will fit together because guanine is big, cytosine is relatively small, but it has the functional groups right here to form these 3 hydrogen bonds, just in the proper location. And thymine will always base pair with adenine and DNA because thymine is a small molecule, adenine is a big molecule, and the base pairing or the hydrogen bonds just line up properly, right, to stabilize the 2 strands of a DNA molecule. So DNA is always going to be double-stranded. And the base pairing rules are going to be what? GC and AT. Probably you kind of maybe you've had a class already in that. So just say GC and AT for base pairing rules for DNA. And the sugar molecule that's used in DNA is a deoxyribose. Ribose is a 5-carbon sugar. And deoxyribose, kind of guess what that means? Deoxyribose, deoxy. It means it's missing an oxygen in some part of that sugar molecule compared to the regular ribose sugar, right? So which makes it a little bit different, not very much different. So here is what DNA really looks like. Let's look at just this two-dimensional illustration and then kind of look at the three-dimensional shape right here. So it's double-stranded, and the backbone, right, is always what? Phosphate sugar, and the other side is always going to be phosphate sugar. So you have the two backbones, and so you should think of DNA as like being a ladder. The handrails are the sugar phosphate molecules. The base pairs point to the interior of the molecule, and they kind of remind me of stairs in a ladder, right? And they always base pair GC and AT right here. So these strands are anti-parallel to each other. If you know the correct sequence of nucleotides in one strand, then you can then determine what the correct sequence is on the other based on those base pairing rules. And because of the three-dimensional shape of these molecules, when we put them together, it likes to form this three-dimensional structure right here that we call also a double helix. All right, so that is the double helix. So these base pairs now are kind of nice and protected inside the interior of a DNA molecule. Okay, so don't forget about that law of complementary base pairing, which says that if you know the sequence of nucleotides in one strand of DNA, then you know automatically what the sequence in the second strand is going to be. Okay, so let's look a little bit in more detail on that ribose sugar and compare and contrast with RNA. So DNA, how many strands does DNA have? Always two, and unless it's being used. And what are the bases that you find in DNA? GC and AT. Those are the bases. So if you see GC and AT in a molecule, you know that's a DNA molecule. Okay. All right, what are some of the big differences? So here on the right-hand side, this is what ribose looks like, right? So it's a hydrocarbon, but it's a carbohydrate. So on every carbon, there's what, an H2O molecule that's broken apart and bound to it. And it's got five carbons, right? One, two, three, four, five. And it's got, ribose has these two OH groups on these carbons that makes a ribose. But deoxyribose is missing one oxygen atom right at this one carbon position right here. So do you think that's a big difference? Okay, it makes a big difference in terms of biology, but if I were to look at this molecule, you know, just kind of walking down the street, I don't know if I would notice a difference in deoxyribose compared to ribose because it's only missing that one oxygen atom right there. But that's enough to make a huge difference in terms of biology, okay, whether it's a ribose or deoxyribose. All right, the other difference in RNA, RNA never contains a thymine base. It has uracil instead. And if you look at thymine and uracil, what else can you say? Oh, they're almost identical. There's only just one carbon where the substitution is different, where instead of a methyl group, a CH3, you have a hydrogen. So again, I consider that pretty much a small difference in molecule, but it means a big difference in terms of biology because the structure has changed. If I saw thymine walking down the street in the uracil, I'm not sure I could notice a difference between them. Okay, but biology does because biology is so in tune with slight changes in structure. The other difference in DNA compared to RNA is that RNA is always single-stranded. It doesn't form a double helix like DNA does. Okay, so in DNA, uracil is substituted for thymine. So RNA does have to base pair. The base pair rules for RNA are guanine and cytosine, okay? And you have adenine, but you don't have thymine right now, so the base pair rules are GC and AU in RNA instead of AT. So those are some of the big differences. So we got deoxyribose versus ribose. Makes a huge difference. All right, so we have three elementary kinds, different kinds of RNA inside the cell, and later on we might learn about some other different kinds of RNA, okay? But the three major kinds are ribosomal RNA. In order for your body to make a protein, it needs RNA to do that, because in order to make a protein with the proper structure, which means then it's going to have the proper function, how do we start to make a protein with a proper structure? What do we have to do first? Like if you have a word like community, how do you put a word like community together? What do you got to start with? A C. You got to know the spelling, right? So you have to know the spelling of that protein, right? You got to put amino acids together in just the right way. The place where amino acids are joined together is a ribosome. So the ribosome is like the workbench where amino acids are put together. So these RNA molecules are important for protein synthesis. Proteins are built on ribosomes. What do you need to make a protein? What's the basic building block of a protein? Amino acids. So a ribosome has to get amino acids from the cytosol in order to make a protein. And they're delivered to a ribosome by transfer RNA. I lost my cursor, sorry. Ah, there it is. Okay. So transfer RNA brings amino acids to a ribosome to make a protein. And you could call this, if you wanted to, a taxi RNA, right? But no one really does, so people will look at you funny. But it's just a little taxi that brings amino acids to a ribosome. And we said that the word has to be spelled properly. And the spelling of a protein is carried by the messenger RNA. The messenger RNA determines what amino acids will be placed next to each other in a growing protein so that it has the proper structure, so that it has the proper kind of function as well. Right, and I think chapter 3, we're going to look at that protein synthesis in just maybe a little bit more detail. All right, but this is just an introduction to it. I don't know, do I have another slide in this? No, that's it. Okay, so if you see a single strand of a nucleic acid, chances are it's an RNA molecule, not a DNA molecule. But there's another thing for sure. Okay, if you see a nucleic acid and it has thymine in it, what does it have to be? It's got to be DNA. If you see uracil, cannot be DNA, it's got to be RNA, because that's the substitution. All right, one last thing I want to say. In order to make a protein, the spelling of DNA has to be ascertained, right? But it's buried deep inside the molecule. So before you can make a protein, the cell has to be able to look at how these base pairs or the sequence, the primary structure of a nucleic acid is put together. All right, and in that case, the DNA molecule actually has to unzip. It has to come apart. Now, is that a terribly difficult process? Do you need really strange salt concentrations or pH concentrations, like in the stomach, to dissolve a protein apart? Or is it easy to unzip a DNA molecule, and why? It's easy. I agree with that. But more importantly, why is it easy to unzip a DNA molecule? Because the two strands are held together only by these hydrogen bonds. And if you want to put it back together again, is it easy to do? Absolutely, because again, you don't need a lot of energy. They're just simple hydrogen bonds. So DNA molecules can zip and unzip all day long, okay, without any kind of problem. Okay, so now at this point in time, you got to become a little bit familiar with some chemistry. And on my website, it's not in Blackboard because it was way too big a file to put in Blackboard. There's a video that you can use to practice some chemistry. Where's this at? It is, I need another window. I have to turn on the display. We got to go here, and voila, we have a window someplace over here. Okay, it's going to justify itself. I still don't see it anywhere. Where did it go? Here it is. I put it away. Okay, I'll put this one away. Okay, so here we have nothing, right? It's just a blank slide. So that's not so interesting. But let's practice some chemistry. And you can practice this over and over and over again. And some parts of the test, the lecture test, are multiple choice. Some parts are matching. And some parts are highly graphical in nature. So I do want you to have pictures of processes, pictures of anatomy, pictures of chemistry in your mind to do well on the test. So we're going to practice some pictures right now. Okay. So here we have, what is this thing right here? I see a phosphate. Here's that PO4. Here is a, how many carbon sugars is this? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's a ribose of some kind. And then we have a base right here. I'm not going to ask you to name this base right here. But this molecule right here, you should be able to tell me something about it. It's a nucleotide. Okay, so this is the kind of thing that can make up a nucleic acid. Now, what kind of nucleic acid? We said we had to look at this carbon right here. Oh, it's nicely highlighted in this color. Right, it's kind of a fancy color. It's not quite blue, not quite red to me. It's kind of like in between, right? So what do we got? An OH. So is this a RNA nucleotide or a DNA nucleotide? It's RNA, right? So this is a ribonucleotide. It's not a deoxyribonucleotide, right? So if this is on the test, you'd want to select ribonucleotide as a building block for RNA, somebody said over here. And what's this? Little rest station. So what group is that that's highlighted? Sulfhydryl group. All right, and what is that? Amino group. That's important to make amino acids. And what do we got right here? Carboxyl group. Right, that makes an acid molecule. This is a phosphate group, and notice when we say phosphate group, we mean inorganic phosphate, and what does it have? It has four oxygens and two hydrogens. Depending on the pH, these hydrogens can come off this inorganic phosphate. Typically, when we write inorganic phosphate in a compound or in writing, we say P with a little sub-I right here, which is a whole lot easier than writing what? P with a double bond and an O and an OH, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have time to write all that. So that's inorganic phosphate. As opposed to if I just had a P sitting someplace, what would that be? That would just be phosphate, right? The atom phosphate. Okay, so that's inorganic phosphate. And then we have, ooh, what molecules are that? You don't have to tell me the specific name. I want to know the class. Is that a sugar or amino acid or lipid or what? That's a sugar. That's a simple sugar. And look, this is a nice six-carbon sugar. You should become familiar with that. And then, of course, it can form that cyclic compound right there. Oh, now is that sugar molecule soluble in water? And why? Or is it not soluble in water? It's soluble from your own basic experience of everyday life. Now, how do we know it's soluble in water? What clues can we see? I see oxygens everywhere. It's just not a hydrocarbon, but there are oxygens everywhere bound to hydrogen. And remember, oxygen, as in water, likes to pull electrons to it. And then this leaves us hydrogen right here with a little bit of a positive charge. So this is a nice polar covalent bond. And polar molecules like to dissolve in water because water is a polar solvent. Okay, so look at all those polar covalent bonds. So sugars love to dissolve in water. Under most circumstances. There's one circumstance I could maybe relate a little bit later on where that doesn't happen. What is this right here? A long hydrocarbon chain with a carboxyl group on the end. That's a fatty acid. Okay, so fatty acid. Now, what kind of fatty acid? You should know, is it saturated or unsaturated? If it's saturated, every carbon is completely saturated with hydrogens. Exactly right. Okay. Well, what do we got going here? Triglyceride formation via what kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis, right? So here is glycerol. Make sure you can pick glycerol out. And then here are the three fatty acids that pulls the water out, three waters for these three different substitutions right here. And then you end up with a triglyceride. So that's kind of a wordy slide. Oh, what's this? I would like for you to say simple sugar or monosaccharide. Again, it's a six-carbon sugar, but the arrangement of these bonds is a little bit different, so the function is going to be a little bit different inside the cell. Metabolism is going to be a little bit different. What do we got right here? This is what we call a micelle. You see a nice hydration state, hydration shell around. Oh, what's the building block of this micelle right here? That is a phospholipid. So here is the polar group of the phospholipid. Here are the two hydrocarbon tails sticking out of it, right? So on glycerol, these are the fatty acids that are bound to it. And then the third carbon of glycerol here is that phosphate group. It's actually a phosphatidyl group. You don't have to know that for here. But that makes it very polar, right? So water likes to associate with the polar head group, but not the hydrophobic tails of a phospholipid. And that automatically assembles itself to make something that looks a lot like a membrane. What are these things right here? Proteins? Those are lipids and in particular steroids. You don't have to tell me the name, all right, but I didn't change the name. This is cholesterol. And then these over here are some steroid hormones. Okay. Now what do we got here? Lipid and acid. Fatty acid, but then what kind of fatty acid? unsaturated fatty acid because of these double bonds. Oh, what's this little guy right here? Amino acid. Okay, just a generic amino acid. Remember that our group can have different substitutions. And this right here, it's probably one of my favorite molecules of all time. What's that? Phospholipid, right? So here is glycerol, here are two fatty acids, here's that phosphatidyl group, here's how it's usually diagrammed. So phospholipid, and what's so cool about a phospholipid? Where does it like to dissolve, in water or oil? It can do both because of the different nature of that molecule, the two different natures. Okay, what are these things right here? Essentially, it's a fatty acid, but it has this hairpin turn in it. These become prostaglandins, important hormones or signaling molecules inside your body. Okay. Oh, what's this right here? This is alpha helix, but what kind of structure in the protein is this? Secondary structure. What's the building block for this right here? Primary structure, right? Which is just a sequence of amino acids. Yeah. Okay. Ooh, what do we got right here? Phosphate, sugar, base. Nucleotide, but what kind of nucleotide? Deoxyribonucleotide, because it's missing that oxygen. So where would this be found, in RNA or DNA? DNA, yep, but not RNA, can't be found there. Then what's that? Hydroxyl group, that's a hydroxyl group. This is glycerol, nice three carbons right here. If we put two glycerols together, what kind of molecule can we kind of make out of it without too much difficulty? If we put two of these together on end to end, how many carbons are we going to have? We're going to have six carbons. What molecule did we look at that had six carbons? Sugars, like a hexose. All right, so your body can actually put glycerols together pretty easily to make other to make a hexose, a six-carbon sugar. All right, what's this group right here? Carbonyl group. And this is, I think maybe this is where we started. That's a ribonucleic acid, not deoxyribonucleic acid. All right, so I'm just going to go a little bit faster, so just look at the slides and tell me what you see. Okay, like that right there. Sulfhydryl group. What's that? Amino group. What's that? Carboxyl group. Phosphate. Simple sugar, yeah, monosaccharide would be a good term for that. And if we put two glycerols together, look what we can make. One, two, three. One, two, three right here. Okay. We can make a six-carbon sugar pretty easily, or your bodies can. What do we got here? Whoops. That was a saturated fatty acid. And then what was this one right here? Stuttered. That is triglyceride formation via dehydration synthesis. But you should also know that this is glycerol, right? And here are three fatty acids. And you should also know how to go the other way. How would you break it down? Hydrolysis reaction, right? Into glycerol and three fatty acids. All right, another compound. Monosaccharide. And then we have a micelle. The building block is phospholipid. And then here we have steroids. And we have unsaturated fatty acid. And there is amino acid, and then phospholipid. Pay real close attention to that structure. I think you saw it real easily because of this head group right here, but look at the structure. Make sure you can see that glycerol in there. Okay, and then what do we have here? Prostaglandins, and now you know where prostaglandins come from. Where do they come from? Can you see that in the picture? Fatty acids. Okay, and they're a little bit modified, so they all have a little bit different structure. Right? They'll have a little bit different structural signature inside the cell. And then we've got secondary structure, or you could say alpha helix. Make sure you know what it contributes to and what helps make it up. That is a deoxyribonucleic acid. And then we got hydroxyl group, glycerol, carbonyl, ribonucleotide. Okay, so you can, and then sulfhydryl group. Oop, let's get back right here. Then we've got amino group, and carboxyl, phosphate, monosaccharide, saturated fatty acid, triglyceride formation, monosaccharide, a micelle, steroids, unsaturated fatty acid, amino acid, phospholipid, prostaglandins, secondary structure, deoxyribonucleotide, hydroxyl group, glycerol, carbonyl group, ribonucleic acid, sulfhydryl, amino group, carboxyl group, phosphate group, and I think that's pretty much where we started. Monosaccharide, once again. Okay, so if you need to practice that, go to the video. And you might have to update your Windows Media Player. If you're using Windows Media Player, sometimes you get the video part but not the audio part. You want them together. So update it, or you can get that DBIX player. Okay, that always works really, really nicely. Okay, so you can practice that quite a bit. Okay, any questions on chemistry? Any questions on chemistry? Well, we can put chemistry away then and go to chapter 6. Okay, do I have that right? We're going to do 6 before 3. Yeah, according to the schedule right here. We're supposed to start chapter 6 Thursday. Okay, but we're going to get just a little bit of a head start today. All right, how's that sign-in sheet going? Okay. Now, the other thing, too, next time as you're coming into class, I'll try to be here right at the opening bell. I want you to have your pre-lecture reading assignments out, and I just want you to show me, okay, that you're working on those. Excellent. And it doesn't have to be typed. You can just print them out and put your handwritten notes on there, but you should be working on those. And hopefully you see a nice correspondence between that pre-lecture assignment and lecture. Does anybody see a total disconnect between the pre-reading assignments and lecture? Hopefully not. It should be similar, right? Okay. All right, so let's see. Let me get my cursor options going right here. Visible. Who's got the sign-in sheet? Is it all the way back at the end of class already? It's still working its way? Oh, it's coming back down. Okay. All right, let's talk about some environments inside your body. The thing that your body is dissolved in is water. That's the solvent. And we like to break the body down into different compartments where water likes to hang out. All right, there's an intracellular compartment and an extracellular compartment. Intracellular actually makes up where we find most of the water. 67% of the water is found inside cells. All right, that's the intracellular water. And then 33% is in extracellular environment, anything outside of plasma membranes. And furthermore, then we can break that extracellular fluid compartment down into two main regions. One is interstitial fluid. Right? This is fluid in tissues that's outside of cells. And then another compartment is the fluid that makes up blood. Okay, and that plasma really is extracellular fluid, but we don't really call it interstitial. We like to think of that as being an active part of moving things around inside your body. So 80% is interstitial fluid, 20%, all right, is blood plasma. And if we put interstitial fluid together with plasma, what do we get? Extracellular fluid, right? And that's about 33% of water inside your body. And that extracellular fluid is contained within a matrix, right? And you kind of know that from anatomy. As a matter of fact, in connective tissues, everything outside the cells is what we call a matrix. And it's a meshwork of collagen and elastic fibers linked together, right? And it moves through like a spongy material. It's kind of like a gel, which is a conjugated protein. It has a sugar molecule bound to it. And so these protein molecules that kind of give the matrix a little bit of structure are what we call integrins. And integrins are, again, modified proteins with a sugar molecule. But integrins then are also bound to cell membranes. So the cells are kind of tied together with integrins. And besides the fibrous proteins, the integrins inside the matrix, it also has that ground substance, which is a proteoglycan. It's a sugar molecule that can absorb a lot of water. So that interstitial fluid of the extracellular fluid resides in what? A hydrated gel of ground substance that we find between cells. So that's a very important water component inside your body. Okay, so you got plasma, the interstitial fluid, and then we have water inside cells. So we're really interested in water because it's going to determine the shape of cells and the pH of these cells, which then is going to determine chemistry and how other molecules are transported around through that watery environment. So let's talk about transport across a plasma membrane. So can anybody remember what the basic building block of a plasma membrane is? It's a particular molecule. It's the phospholipid, right? And it's got a certain orientation. The phosphate groups are pointing toward the outside of the membrane and the fatty acids toward the inside. So a plasma membrane is what we call selectively permeable. It only allows certain molecules to pass through. And the big barrier for passing through a cell membrane are all those fatty acids that are pointing to the inside of the membrane. So it's a big, thick, it doesn't look thick to us, but to molecules it's thick. It's a big, thick, hydrophobic region. So only hydrophobic molecules can actually pass through a membrane. Polar molecules can't. Like sugar molecules can't get through a membrane. Even water can't get through most membranes inside your body unless they have special kinds of things associated with them. So many important molecules have transporters or channels so that polar molecules can move across the membrane. Now, what can you tell me about sugar? Does it like to dissolve in water or not? And why again? It likes to dissolve in water because of all those OH groups, all those polar covalent bonds, right? And it can't get through a membrane because the interior part of a membrane is hydrophobic. It's a lipid part, right, of the membrane. So there have to be certain molecules that allow glucose to move through as well as other kinds of molecules. So transport across a membrane for polar compounds need carrier-mediated transport, which involves a specific protein transport, or non-carrier-mediated transport, which means there actually has to be kind of like a tunnel that goes through the membrane that will allow a polar molecule to move across it. And those little tunnels are what we call channels. Some of these channels are very specific and some are kind of generic. They just allow all kinds of different polar molecules to move across. Okay. So a plasma membrane is just not a phospholipid bilayer, but there are proteins dissolved in the plasma membrane which could be transporters or they could be channels to allow certain molecules to move across. And actually those transport molecules and channels can be regulated by the cell. So at certain times, maybe some molecules can move across the cell membrane, and at other times it doesn't allow transport. So that's what we say is selectively permeable. So the membrane can select what molecules can move across it, but it can also determine what times that molecule. So these transporters can be turned on or off. Okay, so we want to break down transport into two basic kinds of mechanisms. And the two mechanisms are either passive transport or active. Okay, passive transport means that it's a process that will happen automatically. It's energetically favorable to happen. Compounds will move down a concentration gradient from high concentration to low. So that requires no energy for that to happen. Active transport, on the other hand, moves compounds against the concentration gradient. Molecules can move from low to high. Okay, so active transporters in a membrane sometimes are called these things. So here we have, maybe you're out camping this weekend, right? So here we have a little campsite, so here's ground level. And then we got a bunch of water down in the ground over here. All right, and you're thirsty. There's fortunately a pipe that's going down over here. And what do you need to get at that water? You need something that looks like this. And you walk up and you move this thing back and forth. You need to pump that water from low to high. That's an active process. That requires energy. So a lot of membrane proteins that can move things from, that's not on your slide, from low to high, okay, we call them pumps. So it can take molecules from low concentration to high concentration, requiring energy. Take a guess what form that energy has to be in. The universal energy in your cells is ATP, right? Okay. So active transport requires ATP. Passive transport does not require that to happen. All right, so we need to build our understanding of a solution. What the heck is a solution? It's got two components. It's got a solvent molecule, and it's got a solute molecule. The solvent molecule right here is just the molecule that's in the majority, and a solute is in the minority in that particular mixture. And a solvent usually is a liquid that we're going to be concerned with. Okay. So have you used a solvent today? Yeah, what did you use? Give me an example. Like water. In what sense? Because you made some coffee, right? So the water in coffee is the solvent. And what is the solute? The coffee particles. You had maybe some oils or other kind of particles in there. Okay. And so you use little maybe tea particles or coffee particles. That's the solute that you made coffee with. And what's the major solvent in your body that everything is dissolved in? It's a water molecule, just like that cup of coffee, right? And there are, what are some important solutes in your body? Like what? What's in there? Well, you put some coffee in there, but that's probably not so important. Well, let's see. That's maybe kind of important. What was that solute that you put in your body? In particular, the purpose of drinking that cup of coffee. Caffeine is the solute that you put in your body. It's floating around in your body. It has active properties. And maybe you had a caramel macchiato for coffee. What else? What other solutes did you put in your body? Sugar, right? So sugar is in there. That's an important solute. Okay. What's a minor solvent in your body? We talked about water, but there's also a minor solvent. There's another place in your body where other kinds of compounds like to dissolve. And that is the fatty acids that make up the phospholipid bilayer. So the fatty acids on the interior part of a membrane, right? What likes to dissolve in there? Nonpolar substances like to dissolve in that part of the membrane, but it's a really small space compared to the rest of the space of your body. Okay, and also adipose tissue, right? Things can dissolve in adipocytes because there's a big vacuole inside adipocytes that's filled with triglycerides. And so anything that likes to dissolve in oil will find their way into those spots inside the cell, and you can store compounds in that lipid solvent that makes your body. But that's a very minor kind of solvent. All right. What can dissolve in a minor solvent? Maybe some of you have taken another physiology class. Inside the plasma membrane, we can find other molecules that stabilize it a little bit, like cholesterol can dissolve within the phospholipid bilayer because cholesterol is what? A steroid, which is a lipid, so it likes to associate with fatty acids. Okay. So that would be a good example. Okay. So let's now keep talking about transport a little bit. Diffusion is important. Diffusion is an example of a passive process, which means that it doesn't require ATP, and it means that molecules will move from a region of high concentration to low concentration. All right, so if I'm standing here with a perfume bottle and I open up the perfume bottle, it's going to evaporate into the air, and no one else is wearing that perfume, so the concentration in the back of the room is zero, and it's high here in the front. Even though there's not a fan blowing air around, what's going to happen to that perfume molecule? It's going to move from the front of the room to the back of the room. First, the people in the front row will smell it, then the second row, right? And then if we come back next week and keep the doors closed, where will you be able to smell that perfume molecule? All the way in the back of the room, everywhere. And when you walk around, it will have the same intensity because the concentration will be the same. And then, when the concentration is the same, what happens to diffusion of that molecule? It actually stops, right? So in order to have diffusion taking place, there has to be a concentration gradient. The higher the concentration gradient, or the bigger the difference in concentration from one place to another, the faster diffusion will take place. As the concentration equals out, the rate of diffusion will decrease, and when the concentration disappears, right, if the concentration gradient disappears, then diffusion will stop. So here we have, on this slide, two compartments, and there's water in here, and there's some salt. So these little particles right here, let's just say salt or sugar, okay, and it's higher on the left compared to the right. And then if we allow for diffusion to take place, we'll start a stopwatch. We'll see that these particles will then move to the right, and then after a long period of time, the thickness of these two arrows is, and the length of these arrows right here, everything about these arrows is exactly equal. So the amount of particles moving to the left is exactly to the right. So things are still moving around, but there is no net diffusion, right? Things are still moving. And the thing that's moving these molecules around is something we call Brownian motion. You'll get to learn some of that stuff in lab. Brownian motion just means that when molecules are not at absolute zero, they have a certain kind of motion to them. They vibrate, they move around, they wiggle around. And as the temperature increases, that wiggling, that motion increases as well. That's just an inherent property of molecules. They only stop when you get to absolute zero. So that's like the mixer that's mixing things around. So diffusion also increases if you increase the temperature of that particular material. Okay, so the thing you got to remember is that diffusion stops when the concentration gradient goes away. All right, so your body uses that principle to move important molecules around inside your body. So in order to make ATP, does anybody know the organelle necessary to make ATP?
Mitochondria.
And mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP. So fortunately, oxygen is in our atmosphere, right? And it moves into your cells. So where is the concentration of oxygen the lowest on this half of the slide? Is oxygen concentration the highest in the air or inside cells? Okay, and now this is diffusion. Diffusion is what? Passive or active? It's passive, doesn't require energy, so it has to always go from high to low concentration, right? So if oxygen is entering cells, where is it low concentration? Okay, pretty trick question. You got to really think of it, because you think, oh, well, it's got to be high inside your cells to stay alive, but if oxygen is going to go from the air into your cells, oxygen has to be high outside your body and low inside, otherwise it would never go in. Okay, because by passive processes, it can only go from high to low. So cells have a low concentration of oxygen, atmosphere has a high concentration, and that allows oxygen to diffuse into all your cells so mitochondria can use it to make ATP. Okay. If it was, let's go the other way. If oxygen was high inside the cell and low in the air, which way would it go? Would it go inside your body? No, it would leave your body. And that's not what we want to have happen. We want it to enter. Okay. So mitochondria use oxygen, makes ATP, and in the process, it makes CO2, carbon dioxide. That's an excretory product. We need to get that from our body. And it leaves by diffusion, just the same principle by which oxygen enters. So where is carbon dioxide going to be at high concentration? Inside the cell or in the atmosphere? It's got to be high inside the cell, and it's got to be low in the atmosphere, otherwise it would never leave your body. We don't have any special kind of apparatus to kick it out. It just works by diffusion, because our atmosphere is pretty stable. Okay, and the concentration in the air is almost zero, which means that the concentration gradient is huge. So what about the carbon dioxide leaving your body? It's fast, because concentration of CO2 is almost zero in the air. So it's a very efficient mechanism. Okay. Oxygen and carbon dioxide can move through the cell membrane. Doesn't need any special transporters or channels. But some compounds do. So for instance, here is a nice cell membrane. Here is a protein. And this, what can you tell me anything about the nature of the protein? What kind of amino acids are on this end of the protein right here? What's the solvent in this part of the diagram? So let's just say this is inside the cell. Here is the extracellular fluid. What kind of solution do we have right here? What's the solvent? Water, right? So these amino acids right here have to be polar. They have to have substitutions that make them polar. All right, and the same for this end of the molecule. But now what about these amino acids over here in the middle? They have to have amino acids that are nonpolar, because that's what will dissolve next to these fatty acids right here. So this protein will fit right in this membrane really nice, just because of what? The structure of the protein. Okay. And some of these channels can be closed. So here is a pore or channel. It's closed, and at another time, it can be open, and when it's open, it can allow diffusion of this molecule right here, and let's just say this is a charged molecule, maybe like a sodium molecule. Okay, sodium is an ion, it has a plus one. It likes to dissolve in water. Can sodium dissolve in lipid? Nope, because this is a hydrophobic area right here. Right? Sodium needs to be around a hydrophilic solvent, so it can't automatically move across the membrane unless this channel is in the membrane and it opens up, and now this ion can go from high concentration to low. Can you see it's low concentration inside the cell? And then if the cell wants to stop that motion, what can it do? Can close that channel. And even though sodium wants to get inside the cell, it cannot because the channel is closed. Okay, so channels can kind of do that. So we'll summarize something about diffusion next time, but you might want to read through this slide that just kind of shows the mathematics of diffusion a little bit. Okay, so that's it for lecture today. And here is the sign-in sheet. Thank you.